there's an idiom that's been at the heart of my research for the past decade. Here it is in the hook of a song by the Little River Band. Curiosity killed the cat. The idiom can be traced to Ben Jonson's 1598 play, Every Man in His Humor, which contained the line, "Helter skelter, hang sorrow, care'll kill a cat, uptails and all, and a louse for the hangman." It's believed that William Shakespeare played a part in Jonson's play, and later appropriated this line in Much Ado About Nothing. It wasn't until around the turn of the 20th century that the word curiosity replaced the word care, giving the idiom its modern meaning, a warning against the dangers of unwarranted investigation or experimentation. But there's an even more recent version of the idiom that can be seen in Stephen King's The Shining and Iggy Pop's song Satisfaction. Curiosity killed the cat, but satisfaction brought it back. In terms of this cat. In Darrell Ewing's trial a decade ago, there was both unwarranted investigation and experimentation by his jurors, sealing his own fate with the hangman. But that same curiosity that secured his conviction might very well give him a new lease on life.
Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Darrell Ewing. This is the fourth and final episode in a four-episode series about Darrell Ewing, who was convicted of the 2009 murder of J.B. Watson in Detroit, Michigan. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Last episode, we laid out the entirety of the case against Darrell Ewing. Based on allegedly seeing J.B. Watson's shooter through a rearview mirror and maybe through a quick glimpse over her shoulder, Jendai Love identified Darrell after looking at a photo array for about 5 minutes.
If you want to know what the big ticket items from what you told me are?
Sure.
5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
5 minutes. 5 minutes tells me she didn't recognize anybody.
And after apparently picking someone else out of a photo array, Jendai's husband Raymond said that Darrell looks close to the perpetrator based on allegedly seeing the shooter through a rear view and side view mirror. In other words, Raymond made a negative identification followed by what eyewitness experts like Mitchell Eisen call
a relative judgment. And a relative judgment's are more likely to happen under these circumstances. See, the circumstances you're telling me about, you led with the wife.
Mm-hmm.
So the circumstances are that the couple has come to believe with a high degree of certainty that the police have the right guy.
Right.
And that they are, their identification is necessary for justice to be done. And to do their civil duty, they've got to be the witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're given the lineup, and it's like, oh, shit, this is hard.
Right.
These lineups are hard. They are.
Given these relatively weak eyewitness identifications, Tyree Washington's confession, and Darrell Ewing's relatively strong alibi, the repast, you must be thinking surely there was some other evidence against Darrell. But the answer is no. But there were two additional pieces of evidence at trial that did not consist of evidence against Darrell. To understand the first additional piece of evidence, recall the state's theory that this was a two-person job, with Derrico Searcy as the driver of the Blue Aurora, and Darrell Ewing as the passenger who jumped out of the car and fatally shot J.B. Watson at the intersection of Harper and Van Dyke in downtown Detroit. When Derek O'Cersei was arrested for his role in the murder, he was in a blue BMW that was registered to a man named Garland Royal. Police officer Lori Dillon was one of the officers completing the arrest, and while searching the BMW, she recovered 3 9mm shell casings from the bottom of the windshield near the wiper blades. Those casings and other casings recovered from the crime scene were sent to Robert Charlton, a tool mark examiner with the Oakland County Sheriff's Office. Charlton's job sounds simple, determining whether the casings from the BMW and the casings from the crime scene came from the same gun. Of course, as we noted in episode 1 and as Charlton acknowledged in his testimony, no gun was recovered in this case, meaning he couldn't fire a third set of bullets and compare the markings on their casings to the markings on the two other sets of casings. But what he did sounds pretty scientific. For example, here's one Q&A from his testimony.
And that's my next question. What instruments do you use to go about making the comparisons to the specific individual marks that are on each casing? How do you go about doing that? What do you use?
I use comparison microscope. It's a large microscope that has two optics, two separate optics. Basically, it's two separate platforms. I can maneuver each platform back, down, up, and forward. And it has its own set of magnification. And I can put my evidence on one side, or my test on the other, or in this particular case, the evidence and then evidence on the other side, and move that back and forth until I can find that area that I'm looking for.
In terms of how this might all sound to your average lay juror, here's a clip from inside the crime lab.
Any potential associations found using the database are confirmed via traditional microscopic comparisons. This is done using our Leica comparison microscope, which is the primary instrument used by a firearm and tool mark examiner. This microscope allows for the side-by-side comparison of evidence at up to 60 times magnification.
Sounds pretty cool, right? Well, it's not. It's junk science. In 2016, the Executive Office of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, or PCAST, issued a report to the President. The report noted that,
in firearms analysis, examiners attempt to determine whether ammunition is or is not associated with the specific firearm based on tool marks produced by guns on the ammunition. Firearms analysts have long stated that their discipline has near-perfect accuracy. However, a 2009 National Research Council study of all the forensic disciplines concluded about firearms analysis that, quote, sufficient studies have not been done to understand the reliability and reproducibility of the methods. That is, that the foundational validity of the field has not been established. Our own extensive review of the relevant literature prior to 2009 is consistent with the National Research Council's conclusion. We find that many of these earlier studies were inappropriately designed to assess foundational validity and estimate reliability. Indeed, there is internal evidence among the studies themselves indicating that many previous studies underestimated the false positive rate by at least 100-fold.
And while the report held that the foundational admissibility of firearm tool mark testimony was a question for the courts, it left no question about the foundational validity of such evidence. According to PCAST, quote, the current evidence still falls short of the scientific criteria for foundational validity. In other words, if Darrell Ewing was being tried in 2021, he would have had a lot of ammunition for the argument that firearm tool mark evidence should be deemed admissible or at least taken with a huge grain of salt. Here's attorney David Clark.
There's some serious science to challenge this, and I can link to some of the specifics, but basically, this so-called field of science has only existed since the 1920s, and that might seem like a long time, but it's never in that time been really verified to be replicated and testable and leads to any real science results. It's, you know, what they basically do is they look at two things under a microscope and say they look similar, I guess that's close enough to be a match. Well, that's not really a scientific test.
Meanwhile, with the crime scene casings being 9mm, we have another point of corroboration for the confession of Tyree Washington.
What type of weapon did you use?
A 9 Ruger.
Was that a semi-automatic?
Yes, sir, it is.
So, yeah, the 9mm casings from the crime scene definitely could have come from the 9 Ruger or 9mm Ruger that Tyree Washington says he shot, and would lead credence to his claims at a new trial. And of course, circling back around, as noted, the 9mm casings are, at most, evidence of Derrico Searcy's guilt, and not evidence of Darrell Ewing's guilt. Back in 2010, Darrell Ewing's attorney filed a motion to sever Darrell's trial from Derrico's trial, based on concerns that a joint trial would be unfair due to a possible spillover effect from the tool mark testimony.
But that motion was denied in part due to the second additional piece of evidence presented at trial. When Derrico Searcy was arrested, there was someone else with him in the BMW, a man named Mark Davis, and Davis had a cell phone. In that cell phone, he had a contact listed as Apple. Apple turns out to be one of Darrell Ewing's nicknames. And I understand that you came to be given the nickname Apple. Where does that nickname of Apple come from?
That nickname Apple comes from, I was always eating apples and everybody said I had a big old head that reminded them of apples, so that's where it came from.
And so, the state got cell tower records for that cell phone and had them reviewed by FBI Special Agent Christopher Hess, a member of the Cellular Analysis Survey Team, aka CAST. For those of you who listened to our Adnan Syed series, you might recall that FBI Special Agent Chad Fitzgerald, who testified at the reopened PCR proceeding, was also a member of CAST. And all the same issues we raised about cell tower testimony there apply here as well. Specifically, Barton Palace, where the repast was held, is about 4 miles east of the site of the shooting as the crow flies, and slightly over 5 miles by car. The heart of Hess's testimony was about two cell tower calls at 3:07 p.m. and 4:01 p.m. that pinged towers that were closer to the scene of the shooting than the site of the repast. Given that the murder occurred at about 3:40 p.m., the pings couldn't be used to show that Darrell Ewing was at or near the intersection of Harper and Van Dyke at the time of the shooting. But they were used by the state to challenge Darrell's alibi that he didn't leave the repass between about 1 or 1:30 p.m. and about 5 p.m. But does this alibi argument actually hold any water? The answer is no, for two distinct reasons. First, let's look at Hess's testimony in the case of three men who allegedly traveled from Philadelphia to Grand Rapids in Detroit, Michigan, to rob two jewelry stores. In addressing the defendant's challenge to Hess's testimony, the Sixth Circuit ruled as follows.
In testifying about how he used cell site analysis to track the phones in question, i.e. Philadelphia to New Buffalo, to near Medawar at the time of the first robbery, to near Tabris at the time of the second robbery, and then back to Philadelphia, Hess explained that cell phones connect to a nearby tower, but not necessarily the closest tower. Rather, the phones connect to the tower with the strongest signal, so distance is just one factor along with others such as geography, physical obstruction, interaction with other towers, or the number of users in the system. A cell phone could connect to a tower as much as 7 miles away, but obviously a phone in Philadelphia would not connect to a tower in Michigan, nor would a phone in Grand Rapids connect to a tower in Detroit 150 miles away.
But was it even Darrell who was actually using the cell phone? This takes us to the second issue and the reason that Hess's testimony should not have been admitted in the first place. The cell phone, it turns out, was not Darrell Ewing's cell phone. Instead, the cell phone was registered to his sister Sieda. And if you recall back to episode 1, unlike Darrell, no one claimed that Sieda was at the repast the whole time. Instead, multiple witnesses testified that Sieda left the repast to go to a store at about 3 p.m., which would fully explain the 3:07 p.m. ping. Now you might speculate that the state used the call log from the cell phone to identify calls made to and from the phone that were by and from people known by Darrell and not to Sieda. But no, there was none of that. Literally the only evidence the state presented was the pings. And so this is why we say that the second additional piece of evidence presented at Darrell's trial was not actually evidence against Darrell. It also explains why the evidence should have been excluded. Michigan Rule of Evidence 104B covers conditional relevance, or situations where the relevance of evidence is dependent upon some conditional fact. In this case, the disputed fact that Durrell was using the phone on the afternoon of the repast and the murder. Again, the only evidence in support of this conditional fact is that the phone's number was tied to Apple as a contact in Mark Davis's phone. On the other hand, the phone was registered to his sister, and there was testimony that the sister did in fact leave the repast at a time that would be fully consistent with the 3:07 p.m. ping. Simply put, there wasn't enough evidence tying Durrell to the phone, meaning that Agent Hess's testimony should have been deemed inadmissible.
And that's exactly what was done with another category of evidence that the state desperately wanted to introduce at trial. As you might recall from episode 1, in high school, Durrell started a party business called the Hustle Boys.
The Hustle Boys was formed way back in high school. We used to throw parties in high schools and formed the Hustle Boys.
Okay. So in high school, you start the Hustle Boys, you start throwing parties, you're throwing them at Wayne State as well, right? And that becomes eventually your business?
Yeah, that came out business. Yeah, that's basically a source of prime source of income, and it was fun while making money, you know?
What started out as a small-scale business soon grew into a profitable enterprise.
And can you tell me a bit about the operation of Hustle Boys, how you sort of operated in planning and throwing these parties?
Well, we would, we used to use Facebook and Crushbot at the time in the corner and upload our flyers and go up to different high schools and everything and different parties and pass out flyers. And, you know, everybody eventually started to just flock to our parties. After we had one banger, they continued to just keep on coming and our funnel continued to build.
And how many people were in Hustle Boys?
Well, at the start of Hustle Boys, it was really probably, I could say, about 10 at the very beginning, and then they continued to just grow rapidly and rapidly, you know, in numbers.
Yeah. And how successful were you in terms of running Hustle Boys and throwing these parties?
Oh, we were very successful. You know, some nights we could pull in between $10,000 to $30,000 a night.
But through throwing parties, Durrell and his associates came into contact with certain people and vices, and certain people with vices, and they began selling drugs. Indeed, according to Durrell, he was out of town selling drugs until the morning of the murder.
Time we would gather at the front door, after that we went to the repast. I had actually had been out of town, so it had been a minute since I seen my family, and then we all gathered at the repast and stayed together that whole day to about 5.
And let me rewind for a second there. You said before the funeral and repast, you've been out of town. So in the days or weeks leading up to the funeral, where had you been?
I was in West Virginia and Kentucky.
Okay. And what are you doing in West Virginia and Kentucky?
Well, I was down there hustling at that time.
According to Durrell, this was the only criminal element in the Hustle Boys, that they would sell drugs in addition to throwing parties. But the state wanted to claim that it was something more than that. And this was a claim the FBI would later make in 2011 when prosecuting members of the Hustle Boys for drug crimes. Here is an inflammatory news clip from KWXC.
Running the streets of Detroit for the past 4 years or so, but this morning a violent Detroit gang has been dealt a major blow.
Yeah, they're known as the Hustle Boys, and in just a few hours, they'll go before a judge. 7 Action News reporter Kim Russell is live this morning with more on this. Now, Kim, this is a dangerous group.
That's what the FBI says. A 4-year investigation involving state, county, and Detroit police revealed. The FBI also says that this gang was based out of a Detroit home at 7 Mile and Hoover, that the Hustle Boys formed 6 or 7 years ago. And when they started, they were promoting events at nightclubs, but they eventually started dealing drugs like OxyContin and marijuana. Here is a look at some mugshots released of some of them after a grand jury indicted 10 of them. Of the 10 accused gang members, 8 are in custody and face a judge in federal court today. The other 2 are expected to turn themselves in. They're all charged with conspiracy and dealing drugs.
This was an organization that did not limit their criminal dealings to the Detroit area. They often traveled out of state to sell drugs illegally, and they also engaged in acts of violence with other rival street gangs here in Detroit, and they were involved in shootings.
Durrell Durrell admits to dealing drugs and eventually pleaded guilty in connection with this investigation, but he vehemently denies that his work with Hustle Boys involves anything more than that, as he explained to Maggie Freeling.
When I told you I was tiptoeing and dancing with the devil before, I sold drugs, but I accepted full responsibility for that. I never, ever killed anyone. Yeah. And that's the whole issue here, you know what I mean? I accepted full responsibility for my actions that I did and was involved in.
But according to the state, it was more than that. They wanted to claim that the Hustle Boys was a gang involved in the Jets versus Sharks street war, with rival gang the Knockout Boys, which had J.B. Watson as one of its members. But there were two problems with the state's theory of the case. The first was lack of proof. Before trial, there was an evidentiary hearing concerning the issue of whether the state could call police officer Terry Graves to testify about gang hierarchies and how the Hustle Boys and Knockout Boys were involved in gang warfare. The trial judge ruled the state could not call Graves for three reasons. First, she wasn't an expert. According to the judge, quote, "Officer Graves has never been qualified as, by a court, as an expert in the area. She has no written or published articles or other documents, and she has never taught any subjects." Second, Graves wanted to testify that the Hustle Boys was a gang based on what some unidentified person told her about someone else seeing certain people together. The court held that this was hearsay within hearsay and ruled that, quote, "There is no way opposing counsel can cross-examine the testimony because Officer Graves does not recall which person told her what, and she cannot say if that person was qualified to answer that question. Officer Graves is not an expert, and her testimony is not admissible as expert testimony." Third, this left the state's claim that Graves could testify as a late witness, that she'd seen photos of the Hustle Boys using a hand symbol used by the Bloods gang, which proves that the Hustle Boys were a gang. But Graves admitted that a lot of non-gang members use that hand symbol, including a character in a recent popular movie.
"Now this no one wants to do the show. You have 72 hours to get into the Greek Theater in Los Angeles.
Okay.
I'm a motorist.
Oh, this is the slipperiest, most conniving mother on the face of the earth. I want you to go to London to pick him up."
The court thus rejected Officer Graves as even a lay witness, ruling that this sign is a common sign, and this court has seen it used several times by people who are not from and may never have been on the east side of Detroit. This very same sign is used in the movie, quote, "Get Him to the Greek," starring Jonathan Hill and Russell Brand. A huge poster advertising this film and depicting this very same hand sign has been in the window of every Blockbuster movie rental establishment in the area for the last 2 weeks. The court notes that she has not seen this movie, and it appears to be a film for a younger generation. But I do have a, "This is the sign. The Blockbuster people gave it to me, and this is exactly what he shows, this exact sign." This then leads to the second problem with the state's theory of the case. Contradictory proof. As noted, Willie Williams and Philip Reed were in the Astro van when J.B. Watson was fatally shot. They were Watson's cousins, and like Watson, they were members of the Knockout Boys. But while Williams and Reed testified that there were some issues between a few members of the Knockout Boys and a few members of the Hustle Boys, they testified that these were just personal beefs and not gang warfare. They also testified that they weren't aware of Durrell Ewing being in any of these beefs, noted that they'd only seen him in passing, and were not aware of him having any connection with J.B. Watson. This is consistent with Durrell's claim that he didn't even know J.B.
"I heard J.B. Watson got killed the same night that he died."
Uh-huh. Did you know J.B. Watson?
"No, I did not know him."
Nonetheless, Prosecutor Cam Towns pressed this gang warfare theory to the jury, arguing that Durrell Ewing had killed J.B. Watson because he was a member of a rival gang, and that the confession of Tyree Washington was not to be trusted because he was a member of the Hustle Boys and had fallen on his sword for the head of his organization. The case went to the jury on November 10, 2010, and the next day, the jurors submitted some notes to the judge. The first asked for a transcript of the trial testimony of eyewitness Raymond and Jindai Love, and the second asked for the transcript of the preliminary hearing, which also primarily consisted of testimony by the Loves. The judge's response was that, one, trial transcripts take hours to create and that they should rely on their collective memories, and two, the preliminary hearing transcript was not admitted into evidence, so they weren't entitled to it. Fast forward 4 days later to November 15th, and on that date, the juror sent the judge another note. It stated the following.
We have a question. We have a serious difference of opinion on the verdict that we do not believe we can overcome. Can we declare a hung jury?
The judge's response was that the jury should keep deliberating, and that now a transcript of the Loves' testimony would be produced. This prompted defense counsel to ask for what's known as an Allen charge, where the judge instructs the jurors to go back through the evidence, to really listen to and respect each other, and to see if they can reach unanimity. Here's part one of the judge's Allen charge to the jury.
And I can tell you that it's very unusual for a jury to go out and return immediately with a verdict. However, we usually get a verdict. What that means is this. It's normal for jurors to disagree at first, but the fact that we normally get a verdict also means that after reasonable persons lay aside all extraneous matters and determine to decide a case on the basis of the law and the evidence, then they do come to a common understanding and write a verdict. It has never been in this process the intention of a verdict to be that of one person. On the other hand, the verdict of a jury is the collective reasoning of all 12 persons. The reason we have a jury is so that we may have the benefit of the collective thought and reasoning of each individual juror. It may help to tell the other jurors how you feel about the case, and I'm sure you've already done that to a large extent. And I'm not suggesting that you have. On the other hand, it may help if other jurors exchange views with you. And I ask that you listen to each other, and I'm sure you've done that, but I'm going to ask you to revisit that again. And to give deference to each side, and to be willing to compare and consider what one is saying that may disagree with your respective positions.
But the judge denied the request in Durrell's case, ruling that, quote, I don't think it's time for that yet, despite it being 5 days after the case was sent to the jury. The next day, the jury came back with a unanimous verdict, finding Durrell guilty of first-degree murder.
But then, a juror named Kathleen Burns came forward with allegations that tie right back to the judge not giving that Allen charge. In an affidavit, she wrote the following.
Although I did verbalize in court that I voted to convict Mr. Ewing and Mr. Searcy, that was not my honest verdict. I was pressured into reaching that verdict by other jurors who coerced me into that verdict. They told me we couldn't deliberate forever. They told me that I was being too soft. Other jurors jumped all over me and forced me into a verdict. Juror Karen James, seat number 5, told me, "You think all black people look alike because you are white," when I brought up the Tyree Washington's photograph looked similar to Mr. Ewing in the courtroom. I felt Ms. James had inferred that I was a racist and undercut my opinion with other jurors during deliberations. She made me doubt myself and my own verdict.
For Jarrell's mother, Lasagna Dodson, this is a particular point of consternation.
And what made it so bad, it was a white lady who came forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it bothered her. It was black people on that juror who, more like, said, oh no, I worked off, I didn't say nothing. They said, you didn't think to tell a judge? No, I wasn't the one who did it.
Right.
Then that lady stated that they told her, you think all black people look alike? Because she kept saying, no, him and Tyree do look alike.
Right.
And I'm not comfortable with this. And I tried to see if I could see something with my head down. You know, they all did this whole thing. You know, because how many people in the shooting? If somebody's shooting outside my car and I duck down, I ain't finna look up scared that you're going to shoot in my car.
Right, right.
Who going to look up for real?
As Lasagna Dodson notes in this clip, another allegation by Kathleen Burns was that jurors engaged in improper experimentation by contorting themselves in their cars to see if Raymond and Jindai Love could have seen what they claimed to see. This produced results that cut in both directions, but there was something else that led in one direction, toward guilt. Here's another portion of Kathleen Burns' affidavit.
Juror Karen James, seat number 5, brought up during juror deliberations that she had Googled gang information and knew about gang codes and that gang activity involved killing people. Ms. James also said during deliberations that gangs have a pecking order according to information she Googled at home. She went on to say that Jarrell Ewing was at the top of the pecking order. That would put Tyree Washington at the bottom, and the gang decided to sacrifice Tyree Washington by setting him up as the fall guy for the murder. According to Ms. James, the above information was based on what she had read online regarding the history of gangs on the Google website.
When Jarrell Ewing heard this, his guilty verdict finally made sense. He was found guilty because a juror looked up precisely what the state was told it could not present in the courtroom.
When I found out at that moment, I said, you know, it was one of those I knew it moments, you know what I mean? I just knew it, that it couldn't have been the way that these jurors had convicted me, that it had to be some type of outside pressures or something. So when it came forth, I just cried tears that it actually came forth, because jurors don't do that. You know, that's it's becoming a widespread thing with this new social media area that jurors are going out and doing research on Facebook, Google, and Instagram and looking guys up. So it was actually relieving to know that, to hear that this juror come back and always had doubts on me, man, you know, it just brought me to tears, you know?
What Durrell is describing has been dubbed the Google mistrial, based on judges having to declare mistrials when it comes to light during trial that curiosity killed the cat, and jurors did improper outside research in a case. And then there's the Google retrial, where a new trial is granted when these allegations come to light after a conviction, which is exactly what happened here after Kathleen Burns testified that what Karen James found about gang hierarchies changed her vote from not guilty to guilty. In 2017, after hearing from the jurors, Judge Denise Hood granted Jarrell a new trial. But that was just the start of a 4-year ordeal that has been a burden on Jarrell's whole family. Again, here's Lasagna Dodson.
If we wouldn't exhaust everything we have been fighting, protesting, traveling, we'd have been to every court. We've been in front of 11 judges, three panel judge sessions. He's won everything. Then when the juror came forward, and being in that courtroom and hearing that juror state that what happened in the deliberation room, because I knew it had to be something.
What Lasagna Dodson is referencing is the fact that the state has appealed Judge Hood's ruling for the past 4 years in both state and federal court.
Right, so you knew that they were going to fight this, but did you ever think at the time that we'd be sitting here 3.5, 4 years later and they'd still be fighting the same issue that's given you a new trial?
No, I never would have thought that. The whole period of this thing have just been tantalizing. After court, after winning, and they keep telling you that you're going to get a new trial or go home, you know what I mean? It becomes tantalizing. That's what they're doing, like waving a bottle in front of a child who's actually hungry, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you know, you got to get in this bottle to feed them eventually to keep them nurtured. And that's how it's been for me, you know? They've been just waving it in my face time and time again. You know, I can't even believe the system will allow the prosecutor to have these many avenues to continue to try to pull out their pockets of prolonging the inedible.
But finally, as we were about to start this miniseries, the inevitable happened. The state ran out of appeals. That then left the state with a question, whether to take the case back to trial more than a decade after the first trial, or whether to drop the charges. I reached out to the office of Kim Worthy, who's in charge of the case, and received roughly the same response as WDIV.
I did reach out to the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office and was told this is a case where we believe that the charges are appropriate based upon the facts and evidence that we presented in the first trial. That is why we will be retrying this case.
I asked Jarrell Ewing what he would say to Kim Worthy if she were listening to this podcast.
If Kim Worthy was listening to this right now, I would start if I was telling her first that I'm not mad at you. You know what I mean? This has actually been a blessing in disguise for me, you know what I mean? Because I have been awakened to so much pain, but enough is enough now, you know what I mean? The truth is the truth all day long. You know, you said that your office is not afraid to look at previous convictions. You had multiple red flags in this case that scream wrongful conviction from the very start, you know what I mean? I just ask you to continue your mission on saying, getting it right. Get it right with this one here. Get it right with the many more that actually sit wrongfully convicted inside a prison. You know, with 29 wrongful convictions in your offices, something needs to start to be done. You know, now you have to start playing the house of those who are inside your office who are continuing to allow these wrongful convictions to go on, like Larry Krasner did in Philadelphia after 15 exoneration. He turns around and said, okay, let me look at the assistant DAs who are over these cases. And he turns around and seen there was 30 of them that was on all those cases repeatedly and fired them. If you really want to do the right thing, start making moves like that. But get it right starting here, you know.
I've been sending episodes of this podcast to a contact in Kim Worthy's office, and I do believe she's been listening to them. Her office hasn't changed their plan to prosecute yet, but I'm hopeful that this series ends up making a difference. If not, Durrell's next hearing is on June 21st, and his retrial would likely be this fall. In either case, we'll keep you updated and let you know about any developments as Durrell and his family continue to fight for his freedom. Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Of course, I'd like to thank our sponsors. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and you can support our Patreon @UndisclosedPod.